Great, everyone, welcome. I'm Hugo Slim, convener of the Oxford Humanitarian Group at ELEC. It gives me great pleasure today to introduce our two speakers, Alice Obrecht and Philip Tominga. We're very lucky to have them both. Philip's coming from Madrid, Alice is coming from Richmond, which is great, but that's good. The topic we want to look at today, and this continues our series this term on ethical dimensions of humanitarian action, is the whole question of humanitarian accountability. And for those of you that are not familiar, and even those of you who are, the last 20, 25 years of humanitarian work has seen a gradual sort of growth, maturing of the business into what people are calling a profession now of various kinds. In that process, we've seen the movement of humanitarian organizations trying to self-regulate themselves through the code of conduct of the Red Cross and through the emergence of the sphere standards, very technical standards on different areas of food, health, shelter, protection, which is trying to sort of put their house in order so that everybody is doing the same kind of levels of humanitarian work in terms of quality, aligned with the same kind of values of humanity and partiality. And I'm very keen that we understand how that is working, and we've got two real experts today. We've got Alice, who's going to talk to us about NGO accountability. Alice has a brilliant PhD from LSE, which I've been looking at, which is very important on this issue of NGO accountability and NGO as moral agents. And she's going to talk in particular about her experience of evaluating NGOs from her role as senior researcher on NGO accountability at the One World Trust in London. So Alice is going to start for about 20 minutes, and then Philip is going to look at the other end, and Philip produces this every year, which is calling the OECD government donors to account for the humanitarian quality of their aid. So Philip will be talking about government donor accountability in line with humanitarian principles and humanitarian quality of work. So it's a great pleasure you're both here. Alice, if you do 20 minutes, we might then go straight into Philip and then have questions at the end. So Alice,
thank you. Great. Thank you so much, Hugo, for inviting me. And thank you to everyone for attending today. I'm looking forward to the discussion and to Philip's talk as well. So I'm going to talk today about accountability as respect, and there's kind of two components to my talk. The first part is very sort of theoretical and conceptual. I'm going to talk about four main approaches to defining accountability. I'm going to point out some limitations of the first three and argue for a fourth, which I call accountability as respect or moral appraisal accountability. And then the second part of my talk is going to look more at the practical side of these issues, trying to pull out some examples from the Disasters Emergency Committee accountability framework and the annual assessment process to highlight what accountability as respect might look like for some humanitarian NGOs. So kind of two caveats to begin with. One is that while I work for the One World Trust, and the practical examples pulled at the end are from my role on our team providing external validation to the DEC on their accountability assessments, my views here are not identical to the One World Trust views, so there's a difference between the company line and my line. And also that I'm focused particularly on non-governmental organizations. So I know some of you might be more familiar with or have a background with other types of actor and humanitarian work. My kind of angle on this is through the NGO perspective. So I'm going to start off with talking about what is NGO accountability and why is it valuable, and then go into these three specific examples with disaster-affected persons, donors, and then also end with hopefully something that will tie into what Philip is currently working on, and that's these collective accountability initiatives and self-regulatory schemes amongst NGOs. Okay, so starting off with what is accountability? So accountability is a hotly kind of contested concept. There's a lot of arguments over how to define it. It's essentially a type of responsibility that we have in virtue of other obligations that we have towards others. And I think that's kind of a source of the confusion about accountability. So it's a second level or dual level obligation that only kicks in if we already have a prior obligation to another agent. So I'm accountable to you for running over your foot maliciously with my car because I had a prior obligation not to cause grievous bodily harm to you, but I'm not necessarily accountable to you for eating cake for breakfast every day of the week because I have no prior obligation not to do that to you. right? So we have to have a prior obligation. I think in a number of cases, accountability can then become confused or switched around with these other prior obligations. So as an example, sometimes you see in these codes of conduct, organizations sign up to codes of conduct of accountability, and one of the lines that they sign up to is to ascribe to certain principles or values, such as social justice or equality. And I think it's important to try and highlight that living up to those values is a separate obligation from being accountable. You might be accountable for how well you live up to those values, but fulfilling values of social justice and equality does not discharge your accountability obligation. So I think in order to understand different ways of defining accountability, we can focus on the fact that it's a relational notion, and we can look at how different approaches characterize or conceptualize that relationship of accountability. And they can do so by answering three main questions. One is, what is the normative starting point for that relationship between the two actors, the actor who is owed an account and the actor who is expected to be accountable? The prior or immediate obligation that triggers the accountability obligation, the motivations of the agent who is expected to be accountable, why accountability is needed in virtue of their motivations, and then the answers to these three questions contribute to an overall understanding of the function and the value of accountability. So I'm going to go through three of these that I think have certain limitations. The main one, probably the most popular, dominant one, that comes from the private sector is the principal-agent approach to accountability. So some of you may have heard of this before. And in the principal-agent approach to accountability, you have a principal that provides resources to an agent in order that the agent uses those resources to act in the principal's best interest. So that's the normative starting point for the relationship. The agent is then obliged to use those resources in the way that the principal has specified, but the principal-agent accountability model says the problem is that agents will be opportunistic. They'll want to do other things with that funding, with that resource. So this triggers the obligation of accountability. The agent needs to show to the principal how they've spent their resources, and the function of accountability is to constrain the agent's opportunism and ensure that the resources have been spent in the way specified by the principal. So the definition of accountability that you often see that comes out of this framework is that to be accountable means to provide an account to another actor and to face sanctions if performance has not met shared or pre-established expectations. And that's a pretty standard definition of accountability that comes out of this. In terms of limitations, so if we're thinking about this through the specific lens of NGOs, right, there's been a lot of criticisms of applying this framework to NGOs. One of the big criticisms is that it focuses NGO accountability on the donor relationship, which is quite clear why, because that's the main actor from which, you know, NGOs receive resources, financial resources. And people have criticized, you know, that it just focuses all of NGO accountability around the relationship to the donor. We should be looking at other relationships that NGOs have here. And I agree with that, but I also think, moreover, it doesn't even accurately describe the donor-NGO relationship, because something that it misses out on is that prior stage where, I know many NGOs might wish it were the case, but a lot of donors just don't go around dropping money into their laps, right? The NGO has to go to the donor, articulate an identity, make an argument, show them a proposal, show them a plan. They have to make certain claims, in other words. And in exchange for those claims, they get the resources. And I think that's a key component to that relationship that gets dropped out of the principal-agent framework, so we should try to capture that more accurately. A second approach to accountability that's brought from the political sector, as its name sort of indicates, is the democratic stakeholder accountability model. And here you have a political actor that has an impact or is empowered to take an authoritative decision over a stakeholder. That's the normative starting point. The immediate obligation then is to exercise this power in a way that's justifiable to the stakeholder. But the motivations of the political actor may be susceptible to other intervening pressures, and therefore accountability is brought about to ensure that the political actor sufficiently represents the stakeholders' interests in that exercise of power. And this is the one that the One World Trust uses in our assessment of global institutions and organizations, saying if you have an impact on certain parties, then you have these obligations of accountability. And I think that's important when we're looking at global institutions and a lot of organizations, but for NGOs specifically, I still think we can do a bit better, because this model both does too little and too much. So it does too little in the sense that what a lot of stakeholders, NGO stakeholders, want from NGOs is not to have their own views represented, but to have the NGO represent its own expertise in the field when it acts, right? The NGO is enlisted by those other stakeholders in some cases to use its expertise to drive its projects, not to represent the views of others. And in other cases, it's a bit too much. I don't think a lot of humanitarian NGOs should really be accountable to the militias who they may have a negative impact on through their actions, right? So it's a bit too much on either side. But the focus on justification and the need for justification is important. So then we can try multi-party social actor accountability. And this model was proposed by L. David Brown specifically for NGOs, to try and highlight the collaborative nature in which NGOs work. So in this model, you have two equal social actors who choose to join together in a joint collaboration around shared values and goals. Their immediate obligation is to continue to honor and work towards those shared values or goals. That's the basis for the relationship's existence. But other agent-centered interests might intervene. So each social actor may have other interests or preferences that pertain only to them that could come into conflict with that shared enterprise and drive them away from it. And so the function of accountability in this case is to ensure that all parties continue to deliver on those shared values and maintain the collaboration. And so a common definition of accountability here is to demonstrate this continued commitment and to face an exit sanction if you don't continue to demonstrate that commitment. So the sanction here is a little bit weaker than the other two, and it's an exit. One of the social actors is forced out of the collaboration. And I think this gets much closer to the mark, but it still doesn't really capture the entirety of an NGO's accountability relationships, because not all of the collaborations an NGO engages in is one with other social actors of equal standing, in which both parties contribute something of a very similar nature to that collaboration. That works for some of their relationships, but not all. So we have some elements of truth in each of these initial three accounts. So you have the transfer of resources, which I do think is important from the principal agent approach. You have the focus on justification from the democratic stakeholder approach. And then you have this collaborative aspect for the multi-party social actor approach. So here's a way of trying to capture a more holistic approach to NGO accountability called moral appraisal accountability. Here we have an NGO and a potential collaborator that can be any type of other actor. That NGO makes a certain claim to the collaborator. It can be a normative claim about certain values that that NGO identifies with, principles of neutrality, of impartiality, of humanity. They make the claim to the collaborator, and as a result, or it can be a descriptive claim, if you provide £10, we will be able to save this child's life. We plan to do X, Y, and Z in this environment and expect these outcomes. And in response to that claim, collaborators can provide any number of voluntary assets to that NGO, privilege, support, resources, and access. And what's key about this model is that these are the essential components that allow the NGO to exist as an agent or as an actor in the world. Without receiving that voluntary support and collaboration from other actors, the NGO would only have its claims and would be impotent as an actor in the world. So that's kind of the key aspect of this relationship. All right, so the normative starting point is that the NGO engages other parties to voluntarily cooperate with it through these claims and arguments. And that elicits an obligation to maintain a fidelity to those claims and ascriptions of value, to maintain coherence with those claims. And so the motivation here differing from the previous three approaches to accountability isn't that the motivation of the NGO is to shy away from its immediate obligation and therefore accountability is needed to assure compliance, but rather that an NGO should attempt to live up to its identity as a social actor and be motivated to live up to its identity as a social actor by fulfilling its immediate obligation. So accountability should be something that it wants to do because fulfilling its obligations of accountability allows it to realize its identity as a social actor. Right? A social actor that embodies and, or that structures its relationships in a way that embodies respect. And the reason why accountability as respect is positioned as a moral appraisal accountability is because the way in which an organization is allowed to maintain fidelity to its claims and descriptions of values by checking in with all of its relevant collaborators and ensuring that it's behaving in a way that has passed certain conditions of moral appraisal by those collaborators. Okay. So accountability under this account is defined as a structured relationship between two agents in which the accountable fulfills its obligation to ensure that the other party is in a position where it can critically appraise A's actions. It gives an account for that set of actions and recognizes the collaborator's determination of whether their standards have been met and provides an engaged response. So there's no mention of sanctions here because the idea is supposed to be that you fulfill your accountability by engaging in a particular type of relationship, not by facing the threat of sanctions or compliance if you don't obey the standards that are expected of you. It's that critical engagement itself that's important. Okay, so that was sort of part one, accountability as respect. And then trying to look at a couple of practical examples where NGOs are pursuing these opportunities for deeper critical engagement with other collaborators and other parties that they work with. So just to give you some brief background, very brief background to this, part of the work that I've done at the One World Trust is to serve as an external validator for the Disasters Emergency Committee Accountability Framework Assessment. So the Disasters Emergency Committee is made up of 14 leading humanitarian aid NGOs, or agencies, because the British Red Cross isn't technically an NGO. And these organizations sign up to an accountability framework. On an annual basis, they carry out self-assessments against this accountability framework, which consists of 21 best practice standards, or ways of working, as they're called. And then we test a sample of those ways of working. So they fill out their self-assessment against all 21. We receive those assessments, we pick five, and we tell them to collect evidence on those five sample ways of working for two sample countries. So the appeal countries that we sampled last year were Kenya, Pakistan, and Ethiopia, and each agency had to submit evidence against two out of those three. So agencies provide evidence for the sample, and then we discuss their self-assessments and discuss the evidence in a peer validation workshop. And quite excitingly, this year saw the first published version of the report, which is on the DEC website. It's not terribly deep on context, but we're hoping it's a good first step and we'll improve on context for this year. So kind of watch that space for this year's report as well. So a couple examples of standards that we looked at this year. One or two of them actually pertain to accountability to beneficiaries or disaster-affected populations. One of those was a straightforward participation requirement. So way of working 3.3 states that disaster-affected populations participate in program assessment, design, implementation, and evaluation. And one of the strengths that we saw in the agencies for this way of working was a lot of innovation and originality at the policy and framework level. So a lot of organizations really define their own path to how they want to engage with disaster-affected populations. And I think that diversity is actually a benefit because it reflects kind of what accountability as respect is getting at, which is that each agency really thinks about its own identity as an agency and what that means for its relationship with disaster-affected populations. So it's not just a one-size-fits-all kind of approach.
And so we have a lot of strong policy, but we saw that a lot of aid agencies reported some difficulties in seeing those policies and frameworks implemented on the ground and finding the sufficient evidence to show that those policies were being implemented on the ground. A lot of them felt that it was occurring in ad hoc or informal settings, but not appearing in forms. So one of the objections, however, that came up from some agency staff was whether or not this kind of requirement or expectation is actually justified for humanitarian organizations. And this is what I've kind of called the burning house objection, because people seem to use the same kind of example over and over again. And the objection is, you know, if my house is on fire, I don't want to fill out a feedback form saying that I think you did a good job providing me with tea and a blanket. I just want the tea and a blanket, right? So why are you having us do this sort of stuff with our beneficiaries, with disaster-affected populations? And I think that's kind of an extreme case. It's not entirely an accurate reflection of what's actually going on between humanitarian workers and the people that they're providing services to. For one, they do have some type of early interactions when we're doing routine needs assessments, and I know that because they've submitted the documents that reflect those needs assessments, where they're just collecting basic descriptive data on these on the people that they're going to run projects with. And I think there's potential room to include more questions or just ad hoc conversations that occur between aid workers and disaster-affected persons during those encounters, those face-to-face encounters. But really, more importantly, what it also comes down to is the relationship between the humanitarian and the development components or teams within the same organization. Because in many cases, it's not as if the humanitarian worker just comes on the scene and meets a disaster-affected person who's never had any contact or correspondence with their organization. And so usually what needs to actually be improved is the relationships and communications between the humanitarian and development sections within the same organization. Or with larger organizations that are part of an international family, it's communicating within that family a bit better. The other standard that we looked at for under accountability to beneficiaries was a standard that pertains to complaints. So this was changed recently to reflect the change in the HAP standards. So the HAP standards were revised in 2010. And the novel thing about this standard is that it's requiring agencies not to simply set up complaints mechanisms and offer disaster-affected persons the opportunity to complain about their activities, but that they are actually required to consult and prove that they've consulted with disaster-affected populations in designing that complaints mechanism, so that they can make sure that they know it's designed in a way that people can actually use. And I was, you know, very happy to see that many agencies were able to submit strong pieces of evidence showing that they were doing this, because I thought it was quite a tough standard. And I also think that the design component of this standard really touches on that part one of accountability as respect, which is ensuring really meaningful opportunities for critical appraisal and ensuring that the format or the opportunities for critical appraisal that you're offering are tailored to the specific needs of the person that you're engaging with. Another standard that we looked at was value for money, which has been quite a big and controversial issue in the UK aid scene over the past couple years. So this was Way of Working 1.3, Program Design and Procurement Processes Maximize Value for Money. That is, they balance quality, cost, and timeliness at each phase of the response. So we saw that for many agencies, these considerations are being undertaken, but they're occurring still in silos. And the place where we saw the strongest evidence that these different considerations are being balanced together to show how an organization is maximizing the value for every pound that it puts into its work was actually occurring at the procurement level, procurement process, rather than program design. And that's really where a lot of agencies want to be heading. We saw that a lot of agencies are following the lead of the Department for International Development on this, who's really kind of kick-started value for money in the UK. In the UK aid environment, and they have their own kind of equation and definition. But there were also some innovators who are really trying to articulate take this as an opportunity to really reflect and think, what is the value of what we do as NGOs as opposed to other types of humanitarian actors? And so the discussion in some of the workshops revolved around why should we be doing this instead of the military? Why doesn't the UK just send the military in to deliver humanitarian aid? What is the special kind of value that we offer as humanitarian NGOs? And a number of them were including disaster-affected populations in these discussions, which I thought was quite interesting. So I think, some agencies and a lot of people also who don't work for NGOs might look at value for money and think this is a pretty standard example of principal agent accountability. You're essentially being asked to line up your outcomes with a monetary unit. You're ascribing a monetary value to each of your outcomes. That seems quite principal agent. But really, when you look at DFID's definition, it encompasses these different concepts of effectiveness, efficiency, and even now equity or equality, which DFID has kind of brought into the mix. So I think it actually offers an opportunity for NGOs to engage in a more substantive conversation. And again, this is what the moral appraisal approach to accountability is trying to get at, a more substantive conversation about the purpose and meaning of the humanitarian collaboration that they engage in with their donor, to try and think about what is the value of what they're doing and articulate that on a stronger footing to their donors. And then I'll just kind of close with a point about the nature of these collective accountability initiatives in general. I think, such as the Disasters Emergency Committee Accountability Framework, but also the Joint Standards Initiative, which comprises PAP and SPHERE and People and Aid, and then the SCHR, which Philip is now working with. These humanitarian collective agents or collective accountability schemes tend to focus on compliance with agreed standards. And while the individual standards, such as a couple of the examples I've highlighted, can really push NGOs on their relationships with key stakeholders, I have a question about the kind of relationships that occur within those initiatives and within those schemes, because it does seem to still be focused heavily on compliance and providing evidence and verification to one another, rather than opening up a space of more honest, critical dialogue between agencies on their shared projects and on their the shared project of humanitarianism, more broadly speaking. So while ensuring compliance with agreed standards is very valuable, I think we can question the depth and the quality of the horizontal accountability relationships that they provide. And I don't really have an answer to that, just to kind of think about whether or not maybe those are just dual functions that can't both be satisfied within the same scheme. And you need to kind of have that kind of discussion outside of those collective accountability schemes and then focus simply on compliance with standards. But then I would argue you might not be able to call that it's accountability, but a certain type of accountability that you're looking at there. Okay, great. So thank you very much. I went over time.
Alice, thank you for getting off to a very good theoretical and practical start. I think that's given us some helpful models and some real insights into what to do. Philip.
Yeah.
Off you go. Just to introduce Philip. Philip's been working in the humanitarian sector for more than 20 years now, starting initially with UN DPKO in Central America, and then moving into the Red Cross movement in Hurricanes in Central America, and then up into Geneva. For the last few years, he's been at DARA in Madrid, as I said, inventing and consolidating the means of calling donors to account. And you're just moving to SCHR, Standing Committee for Humanitarian Steering Committee for Humanitarian Response in Geneva, to investigate how you might certify humanitarians. Which is an interesting ambiguous meaning from mental health as well. Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you.
I'm not using any PowerPoints. Is it possible to turn this off?
Yeah.
Just a quick question then. How many of you have actually seen this report? A few of you?
Yeah.
So not many. I would, having just left it, it still feels after 5 years that it's still very much kind of my baby or Dara's baby. But there's a lot of interesting material there.
if you're interested in humanitarian, how well the humanitarian sector in general is responding to crises like Somalia or Sudan, Pakistan. The focus is on donors and the relationship and the role of donor governments in particular to making sure that humanitarian responses are more effective and more accountable, particularly to the populations that we intend to serve. So I encourage you to look for that and find, I think, not just information about donors as funders, but also donors as players within the overall sector and some of the big challenges that the sector is facing. Challenges around, for example, how do we more effectively link relief to recovery, to long-term development? How do we avoid failures like the Horn of Africa famine, where there's good evidence that there's increasing humanitarian needs and where preventive and anticipatory approaches might have minimized the loss of life and human suffering? So I encourage you to look at that. Speaking about ethics, I guess for Dara, where we got into this issue of why looking at donors, because most of the initiatives in the sector have come out of the concerns of humanitarian organizations that are sense that we're not living up to the claims, to use your presentation, the claims that we make, that we're there to help people who are vulnerable and affected by disasters, crisis. We're there to provide aid in an impartial, non-discriminatory way. We're there to support their aid. And in fact, a lot of these initiatives have come out of that sense of unease that we're not living up to those claims. We're not meeting our own commitments. And so there's, I think, a lot of dilemmas that humanitarians face every day. Now, how do we do that? How do we balance all these competing demands on us? And how do we make these choices? What kind of choices do we make that will allow us to live up to our claims and to have... I like this idea of relationship because it's something that I've been dealing with a lot too. How do we make sure that the quality of this relationship that we have as an organization and with affected populations and the other stakeholders and supporters allows us to achieve our mission? So there's a lot of choices involved. And I think many of the things that we've heard already this morning about code of conduct or more recently things around sexual exploitation and abuse of power. All of these things are reflections of our own level of dissatisfaction about us living up to some of those kind of ethical standards that we all claim to adhere to. So these codes come up and they evolve mainly because of a failure on our part to live up to those claims and to those commitments. So failures in Rwanda and the Balkans, in the tsunami, Indian Ocean tsunami, have all led to pushing us to try to do better. One of the things that when Dara started its work was to try to evaluate how effectively were humanitarian organizations living up to their claims and how effectively they were actually meeting their mission, humanitarian mission, of preventing and alleviating human suffering. So we did a lot of evaluation work. And in the Indian Ocean tsunami, we specifically looked at the nature of funding relationship and the role of donor governments. And we found that donor governments had, I think, a hugely important role at shaping the way that humanitarian organizations work, affecting the choices that they could make at the operational level about how they were going to carry out the work, how they were going to interact with affected populations. And that was an important component that nobody had really looked at in great detail. A lot of work around, you know, let's follow sphere standards, let's try to be do the best quality programs that we can, let's try to be more accountable. But nobody's really looking at the nature of the relationship of the donors that fund and allow humanitarian organizations to do that work. So that's where the idea of the Humanitarian Response Index came out. when we wanted to look at how donors play part of that accountability relationship, the obvious, the first question came to us, well, how do we measure that? How do we measure the quality of the support that they're giving to humanitarian organizations? What can we use as a way to try to assess that? And the tool that we decided to use at the time was a declaration called the Good Humanitarian Donorship Principles. Back in 2003, a group of, I think, enlightened donor government agencies, and more importantly, a group of enlightened individuals within those donor government humanitarian agencies, said, we have to take responsibility. We have to take certain responsibility for the outcomes of humanitarian actions. The old saying, you pay the piper, you get to hear the tune, is essentially, I think, the realization by some of these donors that we have a responsibility and we have some commitments and accountabilities, not just to the partners that we fund, but also to affected communities. Because from the donor's perspective, whether it's DFID or AusAid or Swiss Cooperation, all of them make that same claim of the shared vision and shared objectives, preventing and alleviating human suffering. So donors, by making that claim, some of them felt that they have responsibility to demonstrate and live up to that. So the Good Humanitarian Donorship Principles set out 23 different principles where donor governments committed to things like making sure that aid is non-discriminatory, it's in proportion to needs, it doesn't say you work over here in this country or you work over there with that group of people. It says we will provide aid resources in ways that allow humanitarian organizations to fulfill their pledge about impartiality, about neutrality, about independence. So there's humanitarian principles that are included in the Good Humanitarian Donorship Declaration. There's also lots of more, let's say, operational issues around we will provide money on time so that agencies can get the resources on the ground and to actually carry out programs. We will not impose conditions on aid that would hamper the ability of organizations to do their work, and a bunch of other different things like that. So for us at DARA, it was a really interesting thing to say, this is what you said you're going to do as donors. This is what you said, or how you will manage the relationship with aid agencies, and for what purpose, for what end, to help affected populations in the most effective way possible. So it became for us a really good framework from which to start to develop indicators about to what extent were donor governments actually living up to those commitments. We developed indicators, a framework, and then we developed a research process to look at how, in practice, donors were doing that in specific cases like in Kenya or in Somalia or Pakistan or Haiti. We did that by talking to humanitarian agencies at the field level about the nature of the relationship that they have with the donors that fund their work, about the quality of that, and how well donors actually facilitated or impeded them from doing a humanitarian action that was principle-based and effective. We also took a look at policies, and we looked at funding patterns. We looked at a whole bunch of different indicators to come up with an assessment that essentially compares 23 of the major OECD donor governments against the GHG principles to say, well, who's doing better and who's not doing so well? Who's better at, for example, maintaining commitment to neutrality and partiality? Who's better at supporting accountability towards affected populations? And develop a comparative ranking on this. So we've done that for 5 years, and now that I've stepped aside from that a bit, I wanted to share some reflections about how well I think the experience has been about making donors more accountable. The first thing to say is that donors, when they talk about good humanitarian donorship principles, all say that we all support this, our government support this, and we apply these standards consistently. And we'll say, well, where's the evidence for that? And there is no evidence. There's no external evaluations for the most part that look specifically about how donor governments are applying those standards. And donors will say, well, we use self-regulation, we do peer reviews, we talk to our partners. And if that was the case, you would expect to see noticeable improvements amongst donors in terms of applying GHD principles. And in fact, what we have seen in our observation after 5 years of this is that, in fact, many of those principles are gradually being eroded, discarded, ignored, and overlooked by donor governments. So self-regulation, by in and of itself, is an interesting process, can help learning. But there was no incentive, we felt, to keep donors to constantly push for improvements and to constantly hold themselves up against those commitments and say, how well are we doing? So it was important for us as DARA to have some external, independent review of donors and to try to use that as an impetus to promote a more equitable, a more responsible, a more accountable relationship of donors with the other parts of that of a relationship, with the partners they fund and with the communities that they claim to be serving. DFID will always say, we're helping the people of Pakistan. Okay, they're providing some funding, but it's usually the British Red Cross or Save the Children or others actually doing the direct relationship with affected communities. But because they make that claim, we felt it was important that they're held up to some external scrutiny. The problem that we found was that our theory of change was that by holding them up to external scrutiny, by holding them up to some indicators of good practice, ones that they've already agreed to, there will be an incentive for donors to look at their scores, to look at their ranking, and to make some improvements. And in fact, many of the donors that we've talked to, the governments we've talked to, have said that this is a perverse motivation. It's a perverse incentive. We don't want to be reviewed. What's your legitimacy as an NGO, as an independent actor, to be reviewing us? So discredit the external evaluation was the first kind of response. Who authorized, who gave you permission to do this? Who gave you the authority to do this? And my argument to donor governments was, well, who gave anyone, an NGO or a government or anyone else, to say that you're legitimate when you're undertaking some humanitarian action? But nevertheless, legitimacy was one of the big concerns. So because we're not considered legitimate, it was an easy opportunity to undermine the work that DARA was doing and to discredit the findings. So that was brought, I guess one of the lessons is, how do you get buy-in from the stakeholders on any type of accountability system that allows you to have the rigor that you need to make sure that there is that it's a credible process, that there's legitimacy in the result, and yet not lose sight of the fact that you have to step back and do some kind of assessment. If you're too closely linked, which is, I think, actually the case in the humanitarian sector, there's a bias in that relationship that sometimes makes it really difficult for you to look at those hard truths. So getting buy-in was one of the lessons that I think we've come to after 5 years of doing this. But finding the balance between getting a sense of legitimacy from donors, credibility on this, at the same time not losing that independence to be able to say to see those types of things. Another lesson, I guess, being targeting. Our theory of change is that if you look at the funding flow, if you can influence and ensure that principles of good humanitarian principles and good practices are part of that relationship between donors and the agencies they fund, then that should also have a spin-off effect at the actual programming level. I think it's a reasonable assumption. I actually do think that that's important and an important component to look at. But what we discovered as well is that 5 years of doing this, and it's, in a sense, we were preaching to the converted. When I said enlightened people, it really was enlightened people within donor government agencies who came up with the good humanitarian donorship principles. And over the course of 5 years, in talking to many donor representatives, whether it's at DFID or AusAid or CEDA or any of them, they are absolutely genuinely committed to maintaining humanitarian principles. And so, and some of them, just to keep it in perspective, humanitarian departments compared to, let's say, development departments within donor government agencies, they're a minuscule minority. And so when we start saying, you should be doing better on this and this and this, I think a lot of them felt personally attacked in a sense that we're trying our very best. We actually believe and are committed to humanitarian principles. But we're not the ones who ultimately make the decisions. So another lesson for us is, who do you target? Where do we want the change to happen? And I guess after doing this for a while, I come to the realization that maybe this is not the place where we should be focusing our energy and our attention. Maybe it should be with the general public, so that the public doesn't put pressure on a government to have a knee-jerk reaction to Haiti or Pakistan while ignoring massive humanitarian needs in a place like Chad. Maybe it's with parliaments to make sure that next time, it's not Andrew Mitchell anymore, is it? So you have some new
Justin
person
Green.
In there. Yeah. So next time the Secretary of State or the Minister of External Affairs is questioned in Parliament, that all parliamentarians know that there's a real reason why these principles and good practices there. We don't have the answer to that yet, but I think one of our conclusions is that if you're going to try to do some kind of accountability scheme and you're trying to get or change behaviors and practices, you have to be really clear about who and where you're going to focus and target those actions. Another kind of lesson learned is, when we started this, the 2007 edition was actually done by economists, two economists from the World Economic Forum, and they came up with a very robust statistical model that said this and this and these types of things can show how donors are doing. And for those of us in Dara who are not economists and not statisticians, we have a good understanding of how that works. But our sense was, wait a second, this is going to go over terribly within the humanitarian sector. Humanitarians, they don't understand this stuff and they don't want to know this stuff. They don't want to have theory. They want to know about practical issues, about how are we going to make this response more effective? How are we going to provide a better quality and more durable solutions to the situations faced by vulnerable populations? And so we moved very quickly away from a very theoretical base to one where we tried to get a more practical methodology, spent a lot of time at the field level talking to hundreds and thousands of representatives of humanitarian organizations about the nature and the quality of that relationship, so that we could start to feed back. And going back to kind of that fourth option, kind of feedback, or the third option, feedback that information, begin to put information on the table that would help to facilitate a better and more effective relationship. But then we ran into the dilemma of are you doing this as a kind of independent, impartial research project with the research results that you just put out there, or are you doing this for advocacy purposes, trying to raise awareness of issues, trying to push for change? And that's a huge dilemma, in fact. And you can get kind of accused sometimes of trying to misrepresent or distort your research findings to fit an advocacy message, or you can say your advocacy message don't match the evidence, or the evidence, which is often the case in the humanitarian sector, runs contrary to what people's common sense understanding is. My former boss used to say, I have a great relationship with DFID. They helped me out wonderfully in Democratic Republic of the Congo. And I said, I can't understand why they're ranked number 8. They should be number 1. If you talk to DFID, I think they would feel the same. But sometimes the evidence that we brought out of it ran contrary to what people's perceptions are about the relationship that they had with donors. And so it was really difficult to find that balance as well. So that's another lesson. We've got 3 of them then so far. Finding legitimacy and credibility. Targeting specifically the type or the people or the organizations where you want to affect change in behaviors. Balancing between kind of evidence-based on the one hand and advocacy on the other. And I guess the last kind of lesson learned out of this was when we started this, what was on the feeling, as I said, that nobody was looking at the relationship and the accountability, the responsibilities between funders and humanitarian organizations. And so we thought we were adding some value to the sector by doing this and adding to some value to the work that other organizations are already doing around the relationship between humanitarian organizations and affected communities. And I think the lesson learned for us, though, is that you need to look at the whole part of that relationship. You have to look at all those multiple stakeholders and talk about those mutual responsibilities and mutual accountabilities if you're going to have an effective framework for accountability. So in the next phase of the HRI, that's something we're going to look at more precisely. How can we also then get affected communities' voices and concerns into this equation so that we have a more complete picture about what these mutual accountabilities mean to different stakeholders and how we can integrate this in a more comprehensive way. For the first 5 years, we really didn't have the resources or, I think, the capacity to do so. But in the next phase, I think it will be possible to do some interesting collaborations at the field level and get and hear from some of the other missing pieces or the missing part of our analysis and perspective out of the HRI. And if we get to that stage, I think it will be really interesting the stories that we'll hear from coming out of this. What, not just about the compliance and commitments, but what are the real challenges? What are the real issues and concerns? As I said, people working at DFID and humanitarian are absolutely committed. They face lots and lots of challenges and obstacles about who do they select as partners in which crisis and how do they deal with the ministers and the media's pressure. Just like an organization like Save the Children or Oxfam or CARE or anyone else has these dilemmas to face. And just, I'm sure, as affected communities, do we want this organization to come working with us? Is this the kind of program that we really want? Does this meet our needs and priorities? So I hope that in the next phase of the Humanitarian Response Index, we'll be able to put all these pieces together in a more comprehensive picture and help us to build those types of a framework that allows us to look at accountability around respectful relationships, about sharing visions and goals, and move us. Yes, it's important to have a framework, and yes, it's important to kind of measure yourself against those frameworks, but I think for us the interesting conclusion from 5 years of doing this is that that's really, really interesting stuff. But it's understanding why things haven't happened, why people have found it difficult to live up to their commitments. What are the challenges and how could we resolve them? That's going to be the interesting story. And that's going to tell us more about, are we being more accountable as different stakeholders in the relationship? Maybe just one final note on the HRI, and then I'll just quickly mention the new project I'm working on. What I think is interesting about these types of things and what's missing in the humanitarian sector quite frequently is that we take a look in a real piecemeal fashion sometimes at a specific program in a specific crisis, a WATSAN program in Kenya, or food distributions in Somalia. And we often don't get the kind of the whole comprehensive picture. And one of the things that I really liked about working on the HRI is that because we visited on average about 10 crises each year, sent our teams to do field research, talked to hundreds of people, we were able to draw out lots of interesting things and commonalities across the globe about where the challenges were for the humanitarian system and maybe some ideas of where things could be improved. And I think that in itself is a valuable lesson, but it's something I hope collectively all of us do. We begin to look at putting these pieces together in a more comprehensive picture and understand and then debate and challenge some of those issues as needed. You know, right now, there isn't any really kind of one single place where you can get good quality thoughtful analysis about the comprehensive issues that we're facing as a sector. So I did, again, encourage you to look at that. Hope you could find it useful. And I hope you support the next phase, because I think it's going to be quite interesting trying to rethink our understanding about accountability and how to look at those relationships. And just to finish, the project I'm working on now is supported by the Steering Committee for Humanitarian Response, which is a kind of an umbrella of 9 of the largest humanitarian organizations, like the Oxfam International Network, the Red Cross, Red Crescent Network, and others. And it's an idea to look at whether or not we've reached a sufficient level of maturity within the humanitarian sector to actually certify organizations, not individuals, organizations that want or claim to be doing humanitarian work in a crisis situation. Could it add value to the sector? Would it help to provide better trust, credibility, confidence in humanitarian actors or not? That's a question that needs to be addressed. And if it would add value, how could it contribute to improving quality, effectiveness, and accountability of actors? It's a question mark. It's more of an exploration. But I think it's an interesting question for me to look at, because it goes back to that kind of original point that I made. We all want to act ethically and responsibly when we work in the humanitarian sector. But sometimes it's really hard to show evidence of how we're doing that, and would certification possibly add an element to help answer or provide evidence of that? I'm not sure of the answer, but if you're hoping that we'll get some lots of feedback and inputs from you. So thank you.
Thank you.